Okay, we're back on the Star Take, and this is a rescue mission story episode. So these are my favorite ones typically, and for listening, lots of people, it's always fun to hear about a rescue story, especially when, you know, it trends positively and it ends up being a positive outcome. So this one, likely lots have heard about. It was a national news type thing that happened, but essentially this is in remote Northwest Territories. There was a plane crash 300 kilometers north of Yellowknife just before the end of the year, right after Christmas. These guys were heading out to a, I guess out in this mine, they have an ice road. That ice road needs to be built. And this plane was carrying the people that were going to put this all together. And so this ends up leading to some of the details that helped them out in the incident. But ultimately, everyone survives this plane crash. So I got lots of emails asking about it, so I'm assuming people have heard about it, and it's cool when it's when it ends up good like this. And it was from 435 here in Winnipeg, the guys I work with every day, so they got to do like a mission of their careers. So all the Star Techs in Canada are trained for missions like this. It's kind of almost the basis that we use for our training. In parachuting, we use the basis of our parachuting for your competency and your skill to be able to do, you know, high wind jump as an example. You do not do these very often. The idea is if you do it with very low frequency, despite the very high risk, if you're skilled and competent enough, you can do it that one time kind of thing in a positive way, which is what ends up happening. But we ultimately train survival, we train mentality, we train our mindset and our grit. We train all of those things around this type of mission, and the guys got tasked on it and got to go save some lives and do something, and it ends up being a good mission. So I decided to sit down with the team member. The team leader has done a bunch of interviews and some TV stuff, so I thought it'd be cool to grab the team member's side of the thing and lay it all out. This is a team member who's been at the unit the whole time. Why? He came to the unit. I'd already been here, and so I've seen the progression the whole time. I did his check ride and things. So it's cool to see someone go through this. We're at a lower task mission. You know, this unit doesn't get tasked as often. When we do get tasked, they're good missions. So it was cool to see this happen. All right, I won't talk very much more. Enjoy the rescue story from Matt Henry. And of course, I have to thank the sponsors of the show. So postseason's going to come up again. Believe it or not, it's coming up soon. So we've got Comox, Greenwood, and Gander. There's other units, that's for sure. But for helping out this podcast, if you're going to one of those locations, Nate King out in Comox, Paul Jackman in Greenwood, and Ashley Bullen in Gander, Newfoundland, these are all fantastic real estate agents who can help you out with resources or, you know, your real estate needs. So all their information is on the website, thestartake.com. And I'm always looking for comments or feedback or questions if you have them. Don't be shy. Email thestartake@gmail.com. I respond to all the emails. Why would you email me? Well, if you want to become a Star Tech and try to understand what that process looks like, or maybe you're in the military and you want to transfer trades, these are the sorts of things. If you want to get fitter, I have some fitness programs. And if you're trying to train for the SAR PT test, send me an email as well, because I can give you some help and some resources out there. And this doesn't just SAR. If you're joining the military or you are struggling to pick a trade or you want some info, email me, because if I don't know it, I can find someone who does that trade and I can get you on the phone with them and they'll tell you what it's actually like, because that's important if you're picking a career or you're picking a job. So I can do that for you. All right. Without any further comments, enjoy this rescue story from Matt Henry. Rescue. So I just kind of like to do it as if we were sitting down and you were like telling us. I've abstained from all these details. I haven't watched Vince's epic interviews, not because I don't want to just like stare in awe of Vince or anything like that. I just have stayed away from all the details, and I obviously know that the mission happened. And kind of followed along with like the overall details, but I actually don't know how it was executed. And so I'm looking forward to hearing it from you. And you were the team member on the, well, we can get into like how you actually got tasked on it, but essentially you're the team member. So from the team member's point of view, Vince was the team leader and did a bunch of interviews. Mm-hmm. It's a blessing and a curse to do something epic on a rescue mission. And so now you get to share your side of the story, and I'm really excited to hear about it because it's an epic rescue from 435 Squadron in Winnipeg. So send it.
Cool. So I actually wasn't the team member. I was the third man. I was deemed third man for this. Alex was the team member. I was called in. I was sitting on my couch, and Vince gave me a call, and he was like, hey, do you want an ops jump? I said, well, yeah, of course. Of course I want an ops jump. It's not really a question there. And he said, well, how far are you from the base? And I said, well, how far do you need me from the base? And he said, just get here. And I said, okay, I'll be there in 15 minutes. So he said, my gear's loaded. I'm all good to go. And for, say, like 30, 35 minutes from my couch, we took off. And we were on the way. It was about three and a half hour transit. And we just built a bunch of bundles. We got everything ready with all the parachutes and medical gear.
What were you told was happening?
So we were told that there was a confirmed plane crash with 8 people on board. We found out later that it ended up being 10 people. The survivors had a sat phone that they were talking to RCC with. So we had a better idea that we had more people on the go. So we elected to build our big toboggan. We built a bundle with the big Arctic tents. We built bundles with extra medical gear. And then we built a bundle with our sleeping and clothing kit gear. So we had those four good to go. And then we got on scene, and it was a 406. So it was like a pinpoint. We knew exactly where it was. And we broke the clouds. We threw a flare to do a terrain and target assessment. And we went all the way down, and we found the target, and we had elected to jump first. That was Vince's choice, was to jump first, because we knew they were there. We knew we had contact with them. We knew that they needed us. So we ended up jumping at about 2,000 feet. That's 48 knot winds. It was a pretty wild one.
No, one more knot of wind. Are you sure?
Well, who knows? Who knows? Okay. We were told it was 48 at 1,000, because that's as low as we got in our training target assessment. Sure. And maybe it went higher down to the ground, but we didn't really know. So we ended up doing the jump. Vince went first, and then Alex, and then me. And we did a really sweet jump. We hit the ground. We all got like super close to each other with how we landed. I think we landed like maybe 30, 40 meters from each other with the three of us, which was like maybe 50 meters from the plane, which is really sweet. So then we landed. I was the first one to get to the patients because I was the closest to there. So I found this tiny little tent, basically like dug in with like wind and snow coming all the way across. And
before we get to the scene though, like you're just brushing over, like jumping in this. So jumping in the winds is one thing.
Yeah.
Really high winds. Something you consider, right? Like, there's safe. We've talked about this before, where you're like, "What's your max wind?" And like, that's just an arbitrary answer because it's different if it's far as the eye can see, wide open fields, and if it's like a small little target we're trying to hit. So that's one thing. But the other thing is like, if you're jumping first, I can only imagine all three of you are carrying a ton of gear.
We do. Yeah, we had a lot of
so
weight on us.
This isn't like a regular jump. You're jumping first, you got to bring medical gear, and you got to bring your initial stuff. Like, the idea is the second you leave the plane, and then the plane, I don't know, hits a bird and has to leave. So, like, how much gear did you guys have?
So we brought 2 pen kits. Alex and I brought a pen kit. Then I brought my survival gear, so I had an extender bag with my survival gear, and we elected to bring snowshoes as well. So we had our 3 bags there, and then Vince had his gear with we brought the shotgun with us because we weren't really sure about animals down there. So I would say like upwards of 100 pounds plus the chute, so looking at like 140 pounds we had.
Yeah, heavy.
Yeah, very really heavy. It was one of the best exits I've ever had.
Well, yeah, because you're stable, you know, because you're just rocketing out of that thing. Okay, yeah, awesome. So you're like fully loaded up. This is daytime, nighttime.
I was about 8:30, so it was dark for sure.
8:30 at night.
Yeah,
night. Oh yeah, up there that far north.
Yeah.
So you're like fully loaded up with gear. You're like number 1, 2, 3.
I was the third one out.
Third one out. Third one out. Sweet.
Yeah.
And what's going on? So. I've been on missions and stuff, so like usually up to when you're actually going to do something, you're going to actually leave the helicopter, or you're going to actually jump. It's all kind of a blur, but I definitely remember like right before you're about to do something, like what was this like? You're obviously carrying a ton of shit, but you're also just about to go and like...
It was really unique. Like there was a really interesting calm in the plane. just with like everybody kind of thinking about what was about to happen. And Vince, we found out what the wins were, and he looked at me and Alex and he said, "Are you guys good?" And we just like both at the same time said, "Yeah, yeah, absolutely, like we're good to go." And then from then on, we just kind of like, I mean, I just stared off into oblivion thinking about what I'm going to do, where I'm going to go, what I'm looking for and all that stuff. But there was like a really interesting calm. And then we always do our little handshake and our fist pump right beforehand. And we did that all like pretty early. We were at like maybe 2 minutes and we did all that. And yeah, we all just kind of went into the zone. And it was just like a really big boat of confidence that Vince was like, "Yeah, you guys good." And then he just went out and we followed him. And it was a really, really cool experience.
Yeah,
I felt really safe, weirdly enough. Because of the training that we got to do and being with Alex and Vince and just knowing that we all understand what needs to happen and we can all just do it really effectively. And I thought it was a really cool experience.
Yeah, that's the pinnacle of Sartek.
Yeah.
Yeah, love it. Okay, so you're down on the ground.
Yeah.
And you're approaching the scene.
Okay. Yeah, so we with the winds, before we left, Vince, basically the game plan was as soon as we got under canopy, release our RSL, as soon as we knew that we could fly our canopy, immediately do it. We didn't have a lot of time because the winds were so high. We jumped to 2,000 feet, so it wasn't a lot of time under canopy. So immediately RSL, and then we came in and we followed Vince in, and then as soon as my toes hit the ground, I immediately cut away.
Yeah.
I look back and my chute's gone.
Oh, yeah.
Gone right behind me. And I was the third one to land, obviously, and then Vince and Alex had already cut away theirs too, and they were like running after the chutes to try to catch them from being blown away in the tundra, and they ended up getting all of them done. I kind of realized that they were doing that down there, and I just elected to go to the patients to see what was up, to kind of get like a primary idea of what was going on. And like I said, we found that little tent with, it was like a two-man survival tent with six people in it. Everybody's feet were like kind of sticking out of the end of the tent. and I just kind of poked my head in and I said, hey, I'm Matt, I'm a Sartek, how's everybody doing? And they were all saying, yeah, we're more or less good. Some person with a hurt back, hurt knee, kind of just complaining of general pain from there. And then I asked the guy who was outside the tent, I said, where is your most injured friends? And they said, there's two guys in the plane with two other people helping them out. And by that point, Vince came up and I told him what I knew. And, he told me to stay with the guys in the tent. And then Vince and Alex went to the plane. Sort of worked with them to find out exactly what the issues were, and there I kind of took a mental note of all the injuries we might be dealing with in the tent, and then I asked them if they need anything else, and they said no, we're more or less good, they're warm in there, they're warming each other up. And then I went to the plane to go help Vince, and by that point we had these snowmobilers from the mine that were like a quick readiness troop that came and found us, and they had taken a bunch of hours to come to get to us. The mine wasn't that far, but it was a blizzard and it was almost impossible to get to us, and we ended up hearing on the radio that they were trying to find us but they couldn't find us. So they saw the plane flying around and they couldn't find us, so I ended up popping a flare and moving it around so they could find us, and they ended up coming to us. And then during this time we were calling the drops for what we wanted, so we ended up dropping the tent and the toboggan at first, because we knew that if we can get these guys out of the elements in the tent, they'll be at least a little bit warmer. And if we can get the toboggan, we can get them food and sleeping gear and water and stuff, and we can kind of hunker in for the night. Because we did know that we were staying till the morning. We did know that the extraction wasn't going to be able to come get us until the morning because of the weather. So we ended up doing that. And while they were doing that, the snowmobile crew that was there, they didn't have any medical training necessarily, just basic first aid for the guys at the mine, but they had a lot of gear. They had the toboggan where the survival gear, they had sandwiches and Gatorade.
Oh, no way.
And they had a backboard, and they had a bunch of random assortment of the lights. They had their small little tent that they had, and they had a bunch of stuff. And because of where the plane was sitting, it was kind of on a kind of like a cornice, kind of like a snow kind of hill. And it was kind of teetering a little bit, and we elected to leave one of the snowmobiles and we dug it into the snow and tied the plane to it so it didn't fall down the hill. It had less of a chance of falling down the hill. While Alex was doing medicine inside with the two guys that couldn't get out because they were in a lot of pain and they weren't able to get out. So we dug the plane in, we made sure the plane was good to go, and then I just kept on going back and forth and checking on the dudes in the tent and then waiting for the drops. And at that point, we had the tents on the ground, and we used the other snowmobile to get our gear, because with the high winds, as you can imagine, as soon as it hits the ground, if the parachute doesn't disconnect like it was supposed to with our GD500s, it would have been gone. So we ended up having two GD500s, one on the toboggan and one on the tents, and the parachutes worked fine. The parachutes were gone. We had the gear, and we got the toboggans, and we brought everything down to where we were going to set up camp. And then we set up the tents.
But there's only two GD500s.
There is only two GD500s, which is an interesting point.
Okay, I'm sorry, I might be jumping the gun here.
Yeah, no. We're getting to that point. So we have the two bundles that we really, really wanted, because we only have two, as you know, on the plane. And so we definitely wanted these things, and we made sure that we had them on the ground, and the parachutes weren't good.
I'll make a quick note, just like the GD500 that we're talking about. It's just this chunk of kit. It has a release mechanism and a timer. So we link it to the parachutes in the bundle, and then as the bundle's going down, the timer is counting, assuming how far it's going to, you know, fall. And then by the time it's fully extended and the timer's out, the second the parachute is unloaded, so the bundle touches the ground for the first time, the little clasp lets go, the parachute leaves, and your bundle stays where it's put.
And the interesting part about that, and you know more than me about the GD500, but we have an 18-knot mm-hmm. wind limit mm-hmm. for training with the GD500s. Obviously, we well exceed that for this mission. But we elected to use them, even though it was outside of our training limits. This is operations, and we were going to go. And it worked great in really high winds, which is a really interesting point. With this in high winds, we always want it.
It fails more in gusty winds, and it has mm-hmm. to do with, like, especially the bigger parachutes, as they load and unload, it can, like, mm-hmm. release. But
it worked really good. And as we talked about, we had a third bundle that we threw. We had a fourth that we didn't end up throwing, but our sleeping and clothing kit didn't have a GD500 on it, and that bundle was recovered approximately 3 kilometers away. So if we didn't have the gentleman from the mine with those sleds, that would have been gone to oblivion, and we never would have got that kit. So we're really lucky to have those guys with us that were able to get it. So so going back to it, we set up the camp. We had the quick pop-up tents, the fisherman tents that we had, the ice fishing tents. And then we had the toboggan, and I sort of started unwrapping some stuff and putting a sleeping bag in here and here and here, waiting for all of our patients to get down there. And then I went back up to the guys that were still in the tent, and we helped everybody get down to the toboggan, or to the camp, into the tents, mm-hmm. kind of starting to warm up. And we had the guys from the mine starting their heater. They had a really nice heater with them. It was like a propane heater with just like an element on the top.
Yeah.
That worked really, really good. Yeah. So he started that up, and
what's
the guys...
What's the temperature?
I think it was like -10, -15.
Without
the wind chill, obviously, it was pretty bad in the wind. These guys were really lucky. I'll get into a lot of reasons why they are lucky, but the temperature is a big one for them for sure. So we ended up getting most of the guys from the tent into our tents at the bottom, and they were more or less good to go. We had one gentleman that had his hurt ankle that didn't want to move yet. We wanted to have everybody moving them together, so we didn't have to walk down this hill. So then we left him in the tent. We left the guys in the heated tent, and then I went up to help Vince with the extraction of our two most sick patients. And that was a very difficult extraction, to say the least. We had to get some pretty sizable guys out of a really small hole. But we ended up
well under the influence of like some pretty heavy drugs.
Yeah, of course.
Not you guys.
No, exactly. Yeah. It was really interesting to see how our drugs worked. So Alex was able to give both of our gentlemen ketamine, which we haven't used yet.
Yeah, this is like the gold star in trauma, mm-hmm. but new to our protocols. We've been using other drugs in previous. Now we have this, like, what they're considering on the street as the gold standard of trauma mm-hmm. care, and we got to see
we
it.
We did.
So,
yeah, it was, or you it guys was really cool. Exactly, yeah. And these guys went from being in excruciating pain, not being able to talk, to laughing and smiling within 5 minutes. So it was great. So we were able to get one of the guys out. We put him on the bed of the toboggan that was being pulled by the snowmobile, and we kind of carted him down. We got him into the tent, and then we came up to get our other friend. And then we got him out, and then we moved him down, and then we moved the last guy with the hurt ankle down to the camp. So then we had everybody out of what they were in before in our heated camp, and then we just started doing medical. We gave everybody a bunch of pain meds, because most of the guys were complaining of back and shoulder and neck pain from obviously the crash.
Yeah.
They were all feeling not 100%, not great, but we used a lot of PO meds, which was really effective for long-term pain.
Yeah, that's by mouth.
By mouth instead of giving them needles. Some of the other guys did elect to have IM needles with our Ketorolac, which is another NSAID painkiller that we have. And they wanted some of that. Some guys didn't. It was sort of like a pick and choose of how much is your pain bothering you and what do you want? And we obviously needed to ration out our drugs. Yeah. We don't have an infinite amount with us. So we were able to get everybody down to a pretty reasonable pain tolerance throughout the night. And me and Alex stayed with our two red patients in our tent doing medical all night. So we kind of just worked with them, made sure that they were getting better, trending in the right direction, doing vitals every hour or so, give them pain meds when they need them, and kind of moving through that. Yeah. What else do we want to get into now?
So let's get some time appreciation here. So like, so you said about 8 o'clock. This is on scene at 8 o'clock?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
So you jump around like 9:30, 10?
No, it was really quick, actually.
If you're rolling up and you already knew it was a jump, you would have had basically everything ready.
So. Yeah, I would say within 40 minutes we were out of the plane. So
we'll call it 9 o'clock?
Yeah, I would say about 9 o'clock. Yeah.
At what time do you have the last patient out of the crap they were in into your
About
camp?
12:30.
About midnight 30, 12:30. Yeah. Okay, and now you're starting this routine at about 1 in the morning.
Yeah,
okay.
More or less, yeah.
Sick. So it's 1 in the morning. You're starting to treat these guys. At any time, was this all just like a blur, work? Did you at any spot, you know, between walking from the tent to the airplane or anything, like stop for a second and be like, are we doing this
right
now?
Yeah. I did.
Okay, I've done this on mission I just giggled because it's just like, this is the situation.
I was in a pretty unique position because I was out of doing medicine at the beginning and I was setting up the tents and I was with one of the guys from the mine that brought the snowmobiles. And I was able to just kind of look around. I'm like, it's a really like nice place, you know, like there was rocks around us, there was this, the moon was out for a little bit, like it was a really kind of cool sight. So I was able to kind of take a step back and be like, yeah, this is cool, we're here. Yeah. We're gonna spend the night out here.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so you start at this point, is there any furthering discussion? The Herc's leaving by now, they're dumping fuel.
Yeah.
They like, I'm 3 hour transit. Like they're dropping their last bundle at Bingo Fuel kind of thing. Like, or do they hang around for a while?
I think they hung around for about an hour and a half, 2 hours after we dropped all the bundles because they were waiting around to see if we were going to drop our third bundle, and it had stuff like the med sled. It had just a bunch of other things that we may need at a Sawzall in there in case we had to cut the guys out of the plane. Instead of using the door like we did, and we ended up not throwing that because Vince is like, no, it had the sub kit in it too. That's just like our additional medical bag that you, the orange one that we have. And we ended up not throwing that, and then it was Bingo Fuel, and then it kind of calmed down again because now it wasn't like blaring with the sound, and it kind of just like, okay, we're here for the night. And we just kind of bunkered in and made sure everybody was good. And then we obviously started going into Hitman. So we have our long-term care. We started, me, Vince, and Alex actually sat down and pulled it out, and we went through every single thing, and we're like, what can we do for this patient, and we ended up finding something. So one of our patients had like a head laceration, and we ended up kind of cleaning it out and putting it back together with the staples.
Wicked.
Yeah, cool. It was pretty cool. And then we elected to give stuff for infection, so we have some drugs to prevent infection over time. Because I'm told isn't done very often.
We usually
don't get to that point in a lot of the missions in SAR. So we were able to pull that out, and we pulled out the protocols, and we talked about it, and then we kind of worked through all that. And we did more or less everything on our list that we do as SARTEX. We jumped in, we did an extraction, we did medicine, we did survival.
Did anyone get a catheter?
We didn't have a sub kit.
Oh,
yeah, so
okay.
it was looking back at when we did our AAR with Vince, he said, you know what, I would have brought that.
Yeah.
I definitely would have had that.
Interesting, because it's in the sub kit, right?
It is in the sub kit. However, luckily for us, the guys that we were with, we were able to relieve enough of their pain that we could assist them to their knees to void their bowels, which was a huge benefit. Because if the guys couldn't, that would have been a lot harder to deal with.
In the chopper, it's the only time you're given... a catheter, really, you're on the chopper. Mm-hmm. And so you, I guess you don't really think about, yeah. And if you're jumping and you're going to stay for a while, you usually have the sub kit. Yeah, that's an interesting piece.
Yeah,
okay.
That is one of the pieces that we didn't bring that in hindsight we should have had.
Yeah, it might not be relevant for lots of people listening, but for me learning from it anyway, that's something to think about. Okay. All right, yeah. And so how long do you guys do this pattern for?
About 14 hours.
So... Yeah. But at the, so it's 1 in the morning. Let's go back to 1 in the morning. Do you guys know, I asked this, I don't know that we covered it, but was there an additional extraction plan yet? Or it was just, we got to wait till first light?
We're going to wait till first light. It was the only available extraction that we had. As you know, there's a unit in Yellowknife, 440, but they weren't available. They were doing some other flight at the time, and they weren't around to bring us any more gear or to come and do any sort of extraction. So right before we even jumped, we knew it was going to be definitely first light, which was around 10:30 in the next morning. So we knew from the get-go that we weren't going to get anything until then.
Yeah.
Throughout the evening, we made sure that everybody was fed. We had enough water. We had everybody monitoring each other's urine to make sure everybody was hydrated and everybody was more or less good to go. A lot of our patients were yellow turning green at this point. The morale was getting like so high around the camp. It was pretty incredible. Like guys going from I can't walk to this is an extreme pain to joking about if they were going to get a full day pay or a half day's pay at work today because of what happened. So it was really, really nice trend coming upwards and just sharing stories about what they do, where they're from. When they're not doing this, like what are some hobbies that they have? Vince, as you know, is a big gun guy, and he was chatting with one of the guys about bullets for an hour in the tent, which was pretty crazy.
We all know who carried the conversation there.
Yeah. Well, and it was the other guy, which is interesting. No, yeah, because he loads his own bullets, and he was talking about grains and stuff.
Oh boy.
Vince is in heaven talking to this guy. But throughout the night, me and Alex spent the vast majority with our two red patients, and Vince just went around the camp consistently every 20 minutes, just chatting with the guys, making sure that their pain was reasonable, everybody was warm, everybody was fed. So Vince was really the workhorse after this point. After he did that, and he was checking in with RCC every 2 hours on the sat phone to make sure that the extraction was still set up and it was all still good to go. But that's sort of how it went until the morning.
And morning out there is like 9 or 10.
It was like 10 o'clock. Yeah.
10, yeah, it's like, yeah. So let's be clear here.
Yeah.
Up there. Yeah. Okay, so 10. Yeah. So like 1 in the morning stuff, this is when you're grabbing your red patients and everyone's in the tents and they've been in the tents for about an hour, so they're starting to... Oh, this is what we're doing, and we're in a movie right now.
Yeah,
we're supposed to
right.
like warm ourselves up and joke and play cards. That's one. It's another 9 hours before anything's happening. Gotcha.
Right.
Sick.
Yeah, okay. And most of our patients were able to get some good sleep in. Us, we didn't. Not really.
No.
Maybe 45 minutes here and there if we're lucky.
Yeah.
Not really good shut eye, just kind of dozing off and waking back up kind of thing.
Yeah.
In the midst of doing our vitals. Every hour to make sure that they were trending in the right directions. Everybody was good. We were checking all the pain and stuff.
What about the weather at this point? We know what the weather was at 9 o'clock at night. What was the weather at midnight?
It was about the same at midnight, and then right around like 2, 3 o'clock, it just died out.
Oh, and it was probably clear.
Silent.
Yeah.
And then after we stretch our backs and get out and go outside the tent and hang out, nothing ever happened.
Right.
You're looking up and there's not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah.
You can see infinitely. You can see your surround. It was really, really interesting.
There's a lot of people, a lot of mountaineers talk about this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think about Everest because, the majority of stories about mountaineering really come out of Everest. But it's like they will sit in these camps with these tents that are like falling apart and just wait. And then... They'll feel like, the world's ending, and then it just goes quiet.
Yeah.
And then they look out the tent, and they see all the stars. They're like, really?
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Imagine 4 hours ago what we were looking at.
Yeah, you guys are jumping in like crazy high winds. And then it's like gorgeous weather.
Yeah.
So that's around 2 in the morning or something like that. And then it's clear all the rest of the night, and then the sun starts coming up. Okay. So, and no, what did the... Mine snowmobile. They just hung out with you guys, or
they had their own little fishing tent with them too, and they slept in there.
So they just kind of set up a camp, went to bed, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Let's all wait till.
Well, I don't want to underplay what they did. They did a lot.
Well,
a
during
lot
that,
us.
Of course.
Without them, that would have been an entirely different story.
You got an extra set of hands
for sure.
And they're driving the snowmobiles. Yeah.
And these guys were hard workers. They were ready to work. They were ready to help. Hey, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And they were really, really helpful.
Yeah, you can't really be lazy in the Arctic. If you live in the Arctic or work there, or you just just can't be. No, you're done if you're lazy. Yeah, yeah.
And they're all really good dudes. They were all awesome. Pretty nice to hang out with. So.
Very cool. Okay, so it's like 10 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
So 10 o'clock in the morning, it's coming over. We hear from Vince that, 10:30 is when the helicopters are going to come. So we give our last dose of pain meds to our red patients, cause we don't know how long this is going to take. We want to make sure that they're feeling good to be able to head off to it. And then we just kind of like cleaning up camp. We're making sure all the medical, and French, just like pieces of stuff that was sitting on the ground to make sure it's, better than when we found it. We made sure everything was picked up. Exactly. Yeah. And at this point, like the vast majority of the patients that were helping clean up camp, like they were feeling good. The spirits were high. They were picking up garbage, moving gear, putting everything together, making sure everything was good to go. And our second red patient, the one that I was with for most of the evening, he's a very unique character. I'll never forget this guy. He's pretty funny. Throughout most of the night, he'd have his little nap and then wake up and he's like, "Can I have a smoke?" He was a big smoker.
Yeah.
And I was like, "No, like we can't, we're living in here. We can't smoke in the tent." And then in the morning he asked me again and I said, "Okay, I'll make you a deal. If you can walk out of this tent, we'll have a smoke." And he looks at me and says, "Sure. Of course I can walk out of the tent." I help him to his knees and he walks out of the tent. and he has his smoke. And then Vince is up on the top getting everybody's gear from the plane, all their luggage and stuff. Yeah. And I call up to Vince and I say, "Hey, Vince." He's like, "What?" And I said, "Our red patient's walking around." And he's like, what? It was a very confused look on his face way up there. And he ended up walking for the rest of the day. And he's just walking around with us, chatting it up, having a great time. Obviously, he was still red due to his previous medical history, which is why it made him red to begin with, and a bunch of his injuries. And now he's walking red, which is really, really unique to that.
Ketamine helps.
He wasn't on ketamine at this point. Yeah, we only gave one dose of ketamine for the extraction.
Gotcha.
The rest of the evening was either ketorolac or our acetaminophen and Tylenol.
Okay.
We didn't do any more ketamine. And then our other red patient, we gave morphine before leaving. He didn't trend in the best direction throughout the evening. He more or less stayed the same for most of the evening. But yeah, he was just on ketorolac, walking around, chilling out. And then we hear the helicopters coming over, so we pop some flares, with smoke rather, and we mark the DZ, and they all land, and we have three little helicopters coming to pick us up. And we load our most sick patients with me and Alex.
So what helicopter is these? From the mine?
From the mine, okay. Yeah.
So the mine had helicopter, that makes sense.
I'm not sure about that. Maybe they contracted them, but they came from the mine and dropped us off at the mine airport.
Cool.
So we loaded our most sick patients in there and with me and Alex, obviously, to go deliver the patients. And we knew that at the airport, there was going to be two planes for us. One of them was a medevac plane that was going to take our red patients and everybody else was going to go in the -7 to head to Yelenov, because everybody was a little bit more healthy than our other two gentlemen. So we ended up landing in the helicopter, transferring them to the medics. And they kind of took all of our information. We gave everything we had from them, and then off they went in their plane. And then we hung out until, because the plane helicopters weren't that big, so they had to do a couple trips to get everybody, and then all the gear and all that stuff. So we made sure we had everything out of there. So we were hanging out in a little heated cabin while we were joking, and the mine got us food, and we were able to get the brownies and sandwiches and breakfast, and it was
nice.
It was pretty nice. And then we just kind of hung out there until it was time to leave. And then we loaded all the gear up on the -7 and then went to Yellowknife, where we then transferred the patients to go to the hospital. And then we went to the HERC. And then we came home.
And the HERC flew home.
Like HERC came home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, rescue, man. Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said that there were some things you wanted to say about... Well, I can say something. I've been to a couple of plane crashes. Mm-hmm. And people don't usually survive. They're usually pretty wrecked. Or, like, if there's three people, there's one, that kind of thing. And then a mass casualty, 10 people survive the initial crash, and then it doesn't go very well. So this seems like pretty, best case scenario, if you can call it that.
It was a best case scenario for everybody involved. It was pretty wild. So a lot of the things went, I won't even say well, went perfect for them in the midst of a plane crash. Mm. So what they were doing on the plane originally is the mine itself is resupped by an ice road. So the people in the plane were going to a camp to open it for the season to build that road.
Gotcha.
So they were expecting to land on a lake right beside a camp that had no power, it had no heat, it had nothing. Mm. So they were all dressed,
dude,
in boots, in their full coveralls, in Arctic jackets and hits and hats and mitts, oh, in man. The plane.
Oh yeah.
Right? So they got out of the plane and they were wearing what they needed to wear, which is a huge bonus for them.
Yeah.
It was approximately 8 hours from the crash to when we got there. So if they didn't have any of that, or they had to find their gear, that would have been a half hour to an hour just to find their stuff, and they're frostbitten by that point and going into hypothermia that whole time. But they were lucky enough to have all of that on them, wow, ready to go, which is a big plus.
You can only imagine that provides some cushion too.
It does, yeah, a yeah. little bit, yeah, wow, for sure. And then another thing that was really helpful to them is, like I said, they were about to land and the camp wasn't that far. I think they ended up telling us it was like 3 kilometers away. So they were at flap 50, which in aviation means they're going slow, mm-hmm, significantly slower. And from my understanding, my very minimal understanding of how this flight path went, is they were flying and they were on final to land at flap 50, and this kind of hill more or less came out of nowhere because of the conditions.
Yeah, and there's illusions. And,
exactly, yeah. Yeah. And then the pilot just flared and just landed on top of this hill. So they just kind of collapsed on the hill, yeah, right? And then you look at the pictures of where the plane landed, and if they would have hit 5 meters lower, they would have been dead center in this thing, which would have been catastrophic, yeah, to the damage of the plane and the people involved. And if they would have overshot it, there was just huge boulders. So they just would have been cheese grated the whole way down.
Yeah.
So a lot of those things went really, really well for them. And then our ability to drop the tents was a huge thing, and the GD500s working were a huge thing, and the guys with the toboggan or with the snowmobile, huge benefit. Like, we didn't even know they were going to be there. Yeah. So a lot of things went really, really well for these guys to be able to survive the way that they did, and they did great. They really did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still needed to, for sure, to get through that nightmare.
For sure.
That's a long,
for sure,
eight, yeah, you know, especially because like, lots of people can get through that first 8 hours. You've got lots of adrenaline, you know, but then maybe you start losing hope and, mm-hmm, like that sort of thing, right? Yeah. So, wow, incredible. Yeah, what did you learn from it?
Quite a few things. The GD500, obviously, that training limit is there for a reason, but it works in high winds. So that was a pretty bonus that I got to learn from that. And throughout my learning of medicine when it came to PO meds was always like, in severe pain, we don't give PO meds. I'm not sure if anybody else had kind of that interpretation of it.
Yeah, I think the idea there is that if you're picking someone up and you're heading to a hospital helipad, mm-hmm, so you're like an hour away, mm-hmm, you don't get PO meds because they,
exactly,
need a surgeon.
And they're gonna get surgery, exactly.
Long term, like, they're not seeing a surgeon for very,
exactly,
quickly.
Yeah,
you know?
And I saw a huge like uptake in morale and excitement just with that alone. With that little bit of pain decrease, and I think that goes a really far way in being with a patient for a long time. So that's, mm, a really big thing that I learned. Mm-hmm. And another big thing that I learned was from Vince is he wanted us to jump light. We knew we were going to throw a bunch of gear, so we didn't want us packing our gear full of things. And I was really like beneficial of that because I had a bunch of stuff packed because obviously you don't know what to expect.
Yeah,
your bags are huge, they're gigantic, and there's so much weight. And Vince is like, hey, just take it down. And I took a lot less things than I was originally going to. Mm. And I'm really happy about that because I used virtually everything I brought. And I didn't feel like I needed anything else. Mm. So to me, that was a really big benefit to know what I'm actually going to use versus what I think I want,
yeah,
which maybe I don't need.
Totally.
Which was really beneficial for me personally in what to pack for a jump. Being that we already had so much weight on us, we don't want to overload that even more, you know. And those are the pretty big things that I learned. And I also learned that Vince's program works, which is pretty awesome. Like I said, when we were in the plane, like there wasn't like a doubt in my mind that we were going to be able to do this successfully because of the training that we were able to get,
yeah,
and the people that we're with and the confidence you're given by your peers and stuff. And those two dudes, they're studs. They did some really, really good work.
Yeah.
And the way that their brains work versus the way my brain works. And like, I don't know if we've talked about this with SAR, like my favorite thing about SAR is that you don't have to be good at everything, because everybody as a collective is good at everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
You put a bunch of Sartex.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, Alex is a wicked medic. And I'm really good at grunt stuff. I used to be in the army, so I was happy to set up the camp and do all that stuff and have it all ready to go. And Alex just crushed all the medicine for all of our really sick patients. And we kind of just, like, collectively did everything really well as a group, which is what I really, really liked.
Yeah. This is, like, my favorite thing about working with Sartex. I've always said, like, if you went and told me I had to do some random task and it was with some Sartex I've never met, I'll be happy to go and do it. I kind of know what 100%. I'm getting.
Yeah.
There's different personality and different, like, interpersonal. Like, 99.9% of it is, like, you just love about that person, and then you just carry on and do the job. So that's really cool. And it's when you do missions like that, too, because you don't always see people's strengths in training. But you can see someone's strengths when something needs to get done, or there's an emergency, or things like that. So you kind of learn from your crew as well. When I hear about that mission as well, we talked about how, like, it's not worth wishing that you were on this mission. Like, this thing can go so wrong. You can show up and everyone's dead. It's just, that's horrible. You can, you know, the jump can go really bad. The plane, something can happen with the plane. Like, this is, like, it's the low frequency, high risk model where we don't do this very often. It's extremely high risk, but we're prepared and trained to go and do it. You don't wish to be in the spot. It would be cool if you're the Sartek that's doing the mission, but you don't necessarily wish it because you just don't know what's going to happen. We look today, and everyone survived. This is a very positive mission, and it's not like you didn't show up and just go, oh, they're fine, and then just sit there. Like, there, you know, you guys played a vital role in keeping everyone alive and that sort of thing. So it's cool to see that, you know, a mission like this really proves our training. It proves what we're doing. It proves how we select people. That's a pretty key point. You know, like, how relative do you think selection was? And making sure someone can go through selection and making sure that they can do what's asked of you there, to know that when you're in that plane, you're looking left and right at Alex and Vince, and you understand that we've all been through it. Like, how relevant? You could say
relevant, 100%. Like, it's kind of like a bonding through trauma thing that we always talk about in the military. Like, you get so close to the people that have experienced similar things to you. And I think it's super important to know that the person beside you has done just as much training and is just as passionate. Because to get through selection, as you know, like, wanting it isn't enough. You need to, like, believe that this is what you're going to do forever. And you need to really trust in what they're going to teach you to be able to have the skills to do something in an uncertain scenario. Because I know you've talked about this a lot on your podcast about what they're looking for in selection. And it's not necessarily people that are amazing at everything. It's people that know how to learn. And because we go into situations that aren't, like you said, we don't do it all the time, but we have the skills to do anything with our ability to adapt and learn and do things. Like, I've never set up those tents in minus 30 winds, you know, with 50 knot winds.
Yeah.
But I knew enough about how to do it and how to shelter it from the wind and how to secure it to the snow with no pegs. Like, there was just snow. There was no ice. There was no rocks. There was nothing, right? To be able just to complete that task without knowing exactly what to do originally. And, like, getting the dudes out of the plane, which was a big thing. We didn't know how we were going to do it, but we knew the vital things we had to do to keep these patients from getting worse. To get them out of the plane, and we knew that we had to get them into a heated area, and we just kind of adapted. And but yeah, that's I think it's super relative to know that people around you are just as passionate and just as capable to do anything,
and that they're going to keep doing it.
Absolutely.
The equivalency is, like, so in selection, you're doing push-ups and you're being yelled at for how bad your push-ups are, and then you're being told to stay in the plank position or the forward-leaning rest position, you know, and which is not going very well for you because it's been like 45 minutes. But it's the person who's, like, just staying in that position. Like, their back is all bent and, like, they're not really doing it all that well, and they're kind of shaking. But because that's the equivalent of being like, hey, you have to hold the side of this plane over while we move this patient, and your hands are freezing, and you're like, what, you're gonna be like, we gotta stop, guys, my hands are cold. No, you have to hold this panel in an awkward, weird position for a really long time while someone messes around with these patients, and your hands are cold, or whatever. Like, I was on a mission the helicopter where my hands were so, I had never felt like this type of cold and pain in my hand, and the next sequence is moving already. This isn't, a time for, well, I need to, and that's it. And now you put us in selection. No one's life's on the line in selection. No one, nothing's happening. Your life's on the line because you're trying to get an awesome job and you're not holding a push-up position. Like, it's not, that's okay. It's just like, we need to know that ahead of time before that person becomes a SAR tech, and it's on that mission where they're just like, I'm not doing that. Or they're like, I can't stand
100%.
Here. 100%. Yeah. So it, the current selection method is very, very important. Okay. Was there any other things you wanted to say about the mission, or you must feel pretty damn good about it? We were on the plane like not that long ago, a couple months, and we were on a mission, and there was an ELT, and we actually went and found this ELT, and you know, there was no obvious signs that this plane was going to be fine when we looked at it, and we were about to throw a flare out to like light up Kurdish country and like, you know, to identify maybe this is a crash plane or maybe it's just a normal plane, and right 10 seconds back from throwing this flare, the guy calls up, it's my plane, I call the stop drop, and just like the, oh, and like, even though it was just like throwing a flare, you know, I really wanted
to throw that. It was my first operational flare.
I wanted you to throw that flare so badly, you know, but we can't do it. And now we fast forward to now, and you got to do like, man, a mission of a career, a mission of the decade, you know, potentially anyway. Certainly there's a couple pretty strong missions, but 10 people... and everyone lives is, and keeping them alive all night. That's like Jeff and PG's mission, you know, to go out to this lake, keep these dudes like, this is like, that's the pinnacle of fixed wing SAR. This is why SAR, this is like what Wat Mae, like the found, like basically the beginning of SAR, wanted to do. He wanted to fly around Canada and find down planes and provide medical care. Like, this is what you guys went and did.
That's awesome. What we were trying to do. That's what we've been trying to do the whole time.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing, Matt. I appreciate it big time. Like, immediately, I had messages asking about this mission, which is funny. I get it. People are excited. Like, I ain't going to skip it, guys. Like, I'm at the same unit. You know, it's like, no, it never happened, you know? Like, but obviously very proud. No big deal. You know, Colonel Chris Hadfield, the Canadian astronaut, gave you guys a shout-out.
He did, yeah.
He said, well done, Air Force, and I nearly made a joke, like, do we just start calling Vince Air Force? Obviously, lots of people involved. But, yeah, thanks for sharing the story.
Yeah, no, that's my pleasure.
Well done. Rescue.